Good evening. Welcome to the Marxist School of Sacramento House. Thanks for coming out once again. Tonight, we have to introduce our speaker, Ian Bull, to my right. He is one of a quartet of editors of a collection of essays titled West of Eden. It's available for sale here at the table to your left. Communes in Utopia in Northern California. I just finished reading it. It's a terrific read. The contributors include Jeff Lustig, who's a retired professor of government at Sacramento. Ian has a couple of pieces in there. Cal Winslow is one of the editors. Michael Glass is one of the editors. And Jennifer Stone is the fourth editor. So I recommend it to you highly. Just one bit of housekeeping before we get finished, before I finish, is if you would please mute your cell phones. Ellen won't take out her sharp hammer, heavy hammer, that way. So we're really excited to have Ian Bull here. He's a social historian, editor, writer. He's with a retort writing group, and he came up in Berkeley tonight to deliver a talk on West of Eden, communes in Utopia in Northern California. Without any further ado, Ian Bull.
Thanks a little more.
Thank you. Thank you, Seth. I'm just going to speak.
You can speak into it if you like.
I don't agree.
It's a boom, so you might just.
I think touch. I need it, but does that help or is that echoey? Does it matter?
No, it's not even on. I don't think.
Well, so.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
I can. You want me to project, or I can just do this?
We can project.
The closer it is.
We want to hear you, that's for sure.
I'd like to make sure of that.
I don't want to get it. There we go. That should go.
Okay. Look, I think I just want to speak loud.
Sorry about that.
Okay? Can you hear me?
I can hear you out of death.
Okay, back. Yes?
Yes.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thank you, Seth and Ellen. Had a nice meal. So I'm going to talk about the genesis of this West of Eden book, describe the results that we got, 7 years, 8 years of work, coordinated by four editors, two of them based in the countryside, and two of us based in Berkeley, a couple of historians, a geographer, an anthropologist. Academicians, but not just academicians. All of us involved in communal projects over many years. I live in a common myself. I'll say a bit more about my own interest in this as we go along. We arranged the project as a with our idea of looking at the city and the country, and the two middle sections of West of Eden are about what we found in our research into a phenomenon that requires explanation to the extent that we were scholars asking a scientific question, wanting to explain something that we still don't fully understand. Who can explain 1968 as an annus mirabilis? For those of us, I guess I'm talking to, you know, the brothers and sisters here who are enemies of the present. 1968, and its own genesis and its aftermath are still with us. A phenomenon that was a global, worldwide one. The Bay Area was an extraordinary nexus an enormous pulse of radical energies scattering out into the hinterland. Tens of thousands of young Americans, and it was, for the most part, a kind of an experiment of the youth. Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds, involved in commoning efforts of all kinds. Commoning is a strange word to use as a verb, but I think I can justify it as a verb, to common. The importance of it now, I think, is because we know that we know, and even people who, as it were, are still dedicated to the virtues of competition, to the reign of the commodity, subscribers to the hegemonic system. Even they, I think, acknowledge that there's a crisis. And of course, crisis is structural, endemic to the system of capitalism. But it's clear that our masters have no plan B. That was brought home to me in Copenhagen. I was on the streets of Copenhagen. I have another book coming out in a few weeks called The Green Machine. It's on a planetary history of the bicycle. I'm a historian of techniques and science is what I teach. And I was on the streets with the bike block in Copenhagen in 2009, December, at the meeting when the managers of the Earth were supposed to gather to come up with their idea of a solution to the ecological crisis. It was pathetic. It was sad to see. And it was very clear that they don't have a plan B. Their plan was to do more of the same. By what do I mean the same? Well, we know what it is. We call it neoliberalism. Further commodification. The commodifying of the atmosphere. The turning of air, of carbon, into a market. The importance of West of Eden, I propose, is because it gives us lessons from this still somewhat unexplained turning away from the commodity. I'm not saying that communards with their whole earth catalogue in Mendocino, in a bucky dome or in improvised structures, weren't buying stuff. They were, but they certainly were felt to be a threat by Madison Avenue and the people who run this country, because there was a distinct refusal to go shopping. A lot of it was like, well, let's do it ourselves. It was a DIY thing. A lot of it was simply a refusal. Actually, a refusal of the cash nexus entirely. I'll say a few words later about whether it was possible to be outside capital. There's a pun there. Could you be outside capital? And if you were bringing up children collectively, as they did in many communes, how were you going to go child-rearing? One of the things that became a point of real dissensus in these collective arrangements was child-rearing practices. Not just do you let Jane or Johnny sleep, cry until they go back to sleep, that kind of issue. Spock 1 versus Spock 2. But what about if you're living in a beloved community where you're communist, with a small c, and you share all earthly goods? What about outside capital? What about if the grandparents are sending in extra toys for one of the kids? I mean, these are the real practical questions. We've got all these interesting narratives about the stories that were told about this amazing burst of commoning, of communalism, which of course has a very deep history in the New World. 19th century utopian projects. The West of Eden begins with a survey of utopian intentional communities. Intentional communities, that's the term that's used now mostly by people who are still rejecting the nuclear suburb and things and decide to live together in some larger numbers, often not that many. The largest commune that we touch on in the book, it's a famous one because it began in the Bay Area and went on a convoy to Tennessee to try to find land that was cheap enough and where they wouldn't be harassed. We'll come back to the harassment in a moment, to the violence. The violence that was meted out both to communards in the city and in the country who tried to make spaces to do something different, to live differently. The violence of the state, the violence of the response, often the extreme violence. We know in the case of, say, the Panthers or the Native Americans, black and red power, they came down extra hard for reasons which have to do, of course, with the history of racism and so on. But even the white middle class kids who were just peaceniks, rusticating in the country, we want to be left alone. These weren't Trotskyists aiming to build a party to seize the reins of the state. Absolutely not. No. Leave us alone. We're going to build out in the country, away from everybody. We're going to make our own lives, learn how to reinvent animal husbandry, textile making, how to dig a well, all that stuff. No, the state came down very, very hard. And that actually will bring us at the end of my remarks. Maybe we could stimulate a discussion after the break. About the relation of this history in the 60s and 70s to the contemporary moment. The chapter on the occupation of Alcatraz, occupied Alcatraz, started to resonate anew last fall with the movement of the squares in Tahrir Square in Cairo, outside St. Paul's in London, in Madrid, in Thessaloniki, Manhattan, and in Sacramento, no doubt. I mean, all over the world, there are people gathering for face-to-face encounters, trying to do, if you like, direct horizontal democracy in very small groups. And all this has to be more or less invented again from scratch. Now, my own interest in this project goes back to, there's two elements to it. One is my, maybe I'll just say it, about the kind of the deep history. For me, because I spent from the ages of 6 to 18 in a communal arrangement, albeit a hierarchical one, quite hierarchical, single sex, very hierarchical, rigid, one in two places, one in the country, deep in the countryside. They were what Foucault would call a carceral situation. I mean, they were, one was incarcerated there. It was a prison-like structure. It was, but we ate together, refection, very large tables. For me, that's the looking back, is the roots of my impulse to try to understand this particular iteration of humans going communal. And again, just to repeat, the book of the commons is back. And historians like myself have been exploring and working under the sign of the commons for 30, 40 years. One of my mentors was E.P. Thompson, one of the group of historians in the English Communist Party, the historians group. And some of you will be familiar with his magnum opus, The Making of the English Working Class. and his central interest in the historical transition from what he came to call, in his own coinage, the moral economy to political economy, or to the economy. Right? Just as an aside, note that economy is a new term of art. It comes into the English language only around 1800 to describe people that we would now call economists. The world's first economist was the Reverend Malthus, Parson Malthus, that Karl Marx, of course, loves to have a go at. Population Malthus. He's the world's first salaried economist. He's working for the East India Company, set up by charter under Elizabeth I. And he's working, he's teaching the boys at one of these schools, like the ones I was sent away to in the countryside, at Haileybury College, which is a school set foundation of the East India Company, to train up young cadres to go and work on the imperial colonial frontier. What Thompson notices as a Marxist, and of course, as you know, Marxists fetishize the economy, but the economy itself is a historical term. Right? We tend to kind of forget that if we talk about the ancient economy, we're retrojecting a category back into the ancient world that only emerges in 1800, precisely with the extinction of common. The world is covered in commonness until the advent of capitalism. And by commoning, one means, as it were, that the inhabitants of a particular patch of the earth have rights of common. That's been the historical right of communities everywhere. I mean, there's a lexical cluster here that I'm playing with. Commons, communing, communalism, communist, communication, community. Okay, these are all related in important ways. Rights of common. If I gave you a list of rights of common historically, I doubt whether many of you know what these would mean, because they've been extinguished. We've lost that right. The indigenous peoples of this continent, they were all swept away in the genocide by the Western Anglos as they punched their way over the Appalachian Crest to enclose America for the gridding out, as you see from the plane, for the gridding out of North America for private property. So neoliberalism is, of course, the latest move in the attempt to extinguish rights of common, because rights of common actually are quite a buttress against capital as it tries to free up labor. That's why freedom is such a right-wing word. We will make you free. And free means free to labor. Okay, free means you are no longer have a right to livelihood. And what is that right? What are these common rights? If I said the word panage, does anybody know what panage is? Chiminage? Herbage? You maybe could guess herbage.
Right to graze your cows.
Yeah. Yeah, the grass. Yeah.
Panage would be the labor, right? The right to the control over your own labor.
No.
No.
Good try. The panage of the beech nuts, the beech nuts for your pigs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Panage. So it's the right to put your pigs in the beech wood.
Oh, you're not saying peonage, you're saying
P-A-N-N.
Panage.
Yeah, peonage would be, yeah, of course. Yeah. Sorry.
Panage.
Sorry, I apologize. Yeah.
I wasn't sure you were saying commons all along, but that's exactly what you mean to say. It's a commoning.
Yeah,
commoning. As opposed to communing or...
Yeah. Commoning.
Yeah.
Commoning. It's mostly a social relation. It's very hard to kind of have a picture of this. This is a social relation. It's a relation between people in a community, and it's a relation of you, of us, whatever, to the land and to its fruits, the treasures of the earth. There would be the right to the gravel in a quarry. The fuel, for example, to keep you warm and to heat up food, that would be estovas. The Magna Carta, the Great Carta, the Great Charter, 1215, 1217, has a companion, a little charter, a charter of the forest, which guarantees, I mean, we're told that the Magna Carta was has been a thing, it's been batted around as a weapon in American political history as well, and all over the world. Subcomandante Marcos invoked the Magna Carta. The Charter of the Forest establishes the rights of the widow to her estovers. The estovers, again, are the downward, the windfall wood that allows you to heat yourself. So it's a kind of hydrocarbon question. We would now say coal or oil, but in an economy of wood, that's important. That's a hugely important right, which at a certain point in history is criminalized. In England, it happens in the 18th century. There's a huge increase in the number of capital offenses, so that commoners are not allowed into the forest. The forest becomes the exclusive domain of the king or the barons or the landowner. In California, the right of commoners up and down the Pacific littoral are extinguished by the establishing of state forests. Public land. It's interesting, we think of public as somehow the opposite of private. Public is good, we like public libraries. Actually, the declaring of some redwood forest as public land actually is a kind of an enclosure. It's an enclosure for the rights to common in there that goes back thousands of years. The inhabitants of this Pacific littoral moving up and down the right to the practice of. It's not a right that is appealed to the court. These are customary practices. To ferns, to mushrooms, to the downwood, and these are all things that a livelihood, right? Commons are, in that sense, means to livelihood. When you hear on the radio again, oh, so-and-so, you know, these people are living on between $1 and $2 a day, you think, oh, that's impossible. They're absolutely immiserated. Well, not necessarily, actually. If they have rights of common, which half the world still does, despite the enclosures and the depredations of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, who would like to extinguish all rights to the treasures of the earth. If you actually have access to commons, $1 or $2 a day is fine. You don't need it. Why? Because you don't have to pay. It's not in the cash nexus. Half the people on earth still are eating not within the cash nexus. It would be a catastrophe if they had to buy their food. And can I ask how many people in the audience were born on a farm? Okay, maybe two or three. Yeah, that's a high number. If I look in a room full of my students these days, let's say a room full of 100 students, there might be one out of 100. So we're at the end of this huge historic shift. As you know, if you're reading Mike Davis, you know, made this claim a few years ago in The Planet of Slums that for the first time in human history, more than half the world is living in cities. And it looks like the urbanization is going on at pace. Kind of an interesting question. How on earth do you make a livelihood in the city? And what's your relationship to the countryside? And that actually became an interesting question for us in West of Eden. How did the communards that rusticated to remote Mendocino, how did they actually get them? How did they pay for their tools? They needed tools. If they were outside the cash nexus. Or maybe they started to commodify things. Yeah, it turns out the first soy burgers commodified, that was up in Lyme Settle in the Sierra. They came into the city to sell them, the soy burgers that they made. So they were commodifying things because it was necessary. They rejected commodification in many ways, but they needed commodities. And sometimes many of them had to go off the commune and to commodify themselves. what we call labor, yeah. Their labor power. A lot of this was improvised. They didn't really know what they were doing. We were fascinated to discover when we did a special study of the communes along Albion Ridge. Do people know sort of the Albion River here? Has anyone been out to the coast? Can imagine it? Yeah, you know, very close to Mendocino town, just a little south. And the ridge goes back several miles. There are a lot of communes on the ridge, along the ridge, of very mixed kinds. Earth Mothers, Marxist-Leninist commune, lesbian separatists. One rather typical one with an older guru, a man who had, you know, was a bit older, wiser, and a sexual predator. This is very normal, sadly. And there's a very good chapter by Jan Freestone, as Seth said. One of the editors is Jan Freestone, who knows Sacramento well and has taught a lot at Davis and is associated with the Native American Studies. And she's an ex-communard and anthropologist and has some very interesting remarks on sort of the sexual politics of these arrangements. From the other side, Peter Coyote's memoir is worth reading because it's shockingly self-revealing about the way that, you know, men would rampage through female bodies, younger female bodies, like the US did through Vietnam, he says at one point. Extraordinary. This is in Sleeping Where I Fall, an interesting memoir. They didn't know what they were doing. They made it up, and it was magnificent in some ways, and kind of crazy. Two examples. One is the buildings. Hippie architecture's got a bad name for a good reason. 6,000 years of wisdom about building just thrown out the window, or never even considered. Hoping desperately that an orbital sander will put things right. Around every corner.
Well, I have a friend who lived there, and she made a living on recycling doors and windows. So they started with recycling, and they used old doors and windows for their buildings.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's just great. It's a, you know, it's terrific. Yeah. Recycling. We like it. But I'm just saying that there were a lot of people who came on Greyhounds from the East Coast and didn't know shit. And had to learn it. You know? That's true. And often the locals, you know, the rednecks, would look at them and say, how's that thing going to stand up? You know, people who had a lifetime of wisdom as carpenters, the people who knew about wood. And pretty soon, we met lots of California communards who had the humility to say, yeah, we need your expertise. And there were kind of, pretty soon the antagonism between the rednecks and the hippies was, Jesse Drew's got a fabulous chapter in here. Young 15-year-old runaway from Boston. He goes into the archipelago of communes, which of course is underground railroad. You've got to understand that any of you, I don't know if any of you lived in any of these situations, it certainly was interesting to discover how many were refugia for draft resistors and for deserters on their way to Canada, for example. Tom Davis, the mine troop. Ron Davis, who's a kind of austere Brechtian Marxist. You'd have thought that he would have been tough on the hippies, right? Because that's the Marxist reflex. Oh, those hippies, they weren't political. They went to, it was back to the landers, they turned away from politics. We stayed in town, we fought the Vietnam War, we fought the man. And I would have thought that Ron Davis would have said that. But actually, he told me something interesting. I've known Ron a long time. I had a good and interesting prickly friendship with him. And I was astounded when he said, I said, well, Ron, what's your view of the hippies in Haight Ashbury? Because he was doing a lot of his political theater in the Golden Gate Park. And that was a hugely important struggle, by the way. The struggle for free speech in the Golden Gate Park, which predated Mario Savio in 1964 at Berkeley. Ron Davis and the Mime Troupe were arrested for doing Commedia dell'arte, for mumming, you know, in Golden Gate Park. Because in those days you had to get permission from the suits downtown. So that was a free speech struggle, hugely important around 1960 in the park. In fact, the presence of the park as a huge common was, and this was the insight of Jeff Lustig, who apologizes that he couldn't be here. Of course, he's an old, sadly, well, he lives in Berkeley, but he's an old Sacramento guy, and many of you will have known him. And in fact, West of Eden is dedicated to Jeff as the Dean of California Studies, as a denizen of the Bay Area, and a radical communitarian with a big heart. Jeff's got a beautiful little piece in here in which is a response to a question that I put to him. I said, Jeff, can you speculate on the conditions of possibility that made all this possible? And by this I mean, as I say, this pulse of commoning, of communal energies. All the, you know, the food conspiracies, the co-ops, the communes. I mean, all the things where people got together in households. I mean, the extraordinary richness of that. And he comes up with a pretty interesting idea. He says, well, I believe that in San Francisco, Haight Ashbury being the focus, that it was maybe the presence, the adjacency of the Golden Gate Park. I think that's true. Not that the park was like an ancient common where people were, although some people were, taking wood for campfires. But it was a space to gather, for sure. Although certain kinds of gathering were criminalized, namely doing radical political theater. So the adjacency on the west side of the park, which, by the way, was a working class victory. You can be sure that the big developers, and Gray Brecken will back me up on this, the big developers had the very clear plan for the Golden Gate Park. They were going to, of course, turn it completely over to housing development. But the people of San Francisco said no after the Panama Pacific Exposition of 1915, said no, we're not going to let you do that. We want to keep the park. And we want to keep the Palace of Fine Arts, even though that was only supposed to be up there a few months. So we still have both those. So that's a victory we should celebrate. It's kind of a negative one. They haven't destroyed it. In the same way that, you know, it's well known, Sylvia McLaughlin and some very strong, willful bourgeois women with time on their hands because they're husbands earn big salaries on the university and the administrators, whatever, and they saved the Bay. Some of you might know my colleague from the geography department, Dick Walker's great book on the history of environmentalism in the Bay. And he spent some time looking at that struggle. So on the west side you have the Golden Gate Park, and in the East Bay you have, of course, the campus as a common adjacent to Telegraph Avenue and so on. So that suggests that the current struggles by the Occupy movement face a similar kind of problem. When the police come onto a campus with pepper spray or batons or whatever, we should remember that there's a deep history to the resistance by those in power to anybody wishing to make spaces for alternative ways of living. So that was one, the building question. I should just finish by saying that Haight Ashbury was a site adjacent to the common, partly because the Irish, who were there in great numbers, had moved out of the Painted Ladies and the great those lovely Victorian houses to the suburbs in the 50s and 60s, and there was housing stock for the communards, these improvised spaces. Again, they were improvised in a way that in the 19th century they weren't. Timothy Miller, who has the opening survey, he's the great sociologist of utopian communities in the New World. I mean, often these were fantastically ambitious things. Some of you might have read the history of, I don't know, something like New Harmony, or, you know, the Shaker communities, the opposite in terms of carpentry, you know, the beautiful Shaker furniture, it was exquisite. No, a lot of this was improvised stuff, in the case of Haight Ashbury. And in the city downtown, or at the foot of Potrero Hill, the communes there in abandoned factories and warehouses. Project Arto, Project One, the very early proto-internet story of using a big mainframe computer in Project One, Project Arto. Big struggle with the city again, you're out of code. You know, the fire marshal always has the last word.
Or code enforcement.
Yeah, we came to call them the code wars. I mean, a lot of people were just ground down. By 1980, they were just exhausted by the code wars, the building codes. I mean, there's actually 27 violations in this room alone, I've counted. This room is out of code in 27 ways that I've counted. Now, it's probably 85, but why hasn't the building inspector been round? Well, depends what you do here. If what happens here becomes threatening enough, the state will come down and say you're out of code. And that'll be one of the ways. Oh, it's a Coddy Park, it's rats, it's whatever it is. Now, this is urban corruption 101. Anyone who has a club or anything knows that you're only open because they haven't shut you down. Because they can. So the building is one question. They didn't really know what they were doing, but they improvised superbly. One of the poignant things we found as we did our research into this history, and some of us were involved in some of these projects, was how ultimately sad, looking back, once, say, something like Project Arto had been legalized, took 20 years to legalize this big building in San Francisco. Turns out that was kind of not the point. It was boring. The excitement was in the early days, the radical collective energies in the very early days, long before it was, when it was still a criminal. It was a story of more and more sheetrock, more and more locks, more and more turning into what the world that you wanted to reject. Second thing is, they didn't know what they're doing. I mean, it was amazing, back to the commune question. Turns out that we found one of the communes up in Mendocino was coming over into the Central Valley, making arrangements with farmers to use the leftovers from the harvest. What they called canning weekends. They didn't know the word. I mean, what is the word, by the way, for picking up after the harvest?
Gleaning.
Right. These are people who didn't know, had never heard the word glean. They reinvented gleaning, an age-old immemorial right to what's left over from the harvest. Which is, by the way, not a trivial, by no means a trivial right. Jeanette Neeson, who's one of the great historians of the English Commons, has calculated that the right to glean after the corn harvest, by corn, not in the corn as maize, but corn as generic cereal, to be able to pick up barley or wheat or oats, that right might amount to 3 or 4 months of bread for a family. That's not trivial, right? So gleaning had to be reinvented. All these things we discovered just by talking to the ex-communards in their reflections. One of the, we've got a few more minutes.
Yes.
Another 5 minutes. Very rich set of reflections and descriptions in West of Eden, but let me just say a couple of more things. One thing about the unmastered nature of this path, there's still a struggle over what the 60s meant. There's still a struggle over the meaning of the commune, the Ur commune, the commune of 1871 in Paris, which was a very powerful powerful term, and most since the 60s, very few people have called themselves something commune. Interesting to see it flash up suddenly in San Francisco and Oakland. The word commune being owned again. Okay. The Paris Commune ended badly with the massacre of 30,000 or so communards, Parisians, mown down by the French state during what was essentially a civil war, triggered by the war between France and Prussia. And I don't think one can overestimate the effect of, on the one hand, these very personal experiences, which might have only lasted, in the case of the Paris Commune, 73 days. Some people in we've spoken to had experiences that were shorter than that. Maybe it was a short summer experience in a household in which there was intense engagement, in which they realized that what they were doing was being intentional, because after all, most of us are thrown into households which are kind of unintentional, the default position of the you know, say the white American family. So you couldn't tell by how long or how short something was, how powerful it was, what it meant. And I got a very sharp lesson at our first gathering, when we brought together lots of communards on Albion Ridge, and there were the two editors, Cal and Jantry, were there from Mendocino, and Michael Watts and I came up from Berkeley, and I was chairing it. It was a schoolroom which they had built collectively, several, many communes along the ridge, and we sat around. And after 2 or 3 hours of people beginning to reflect on these, which they hadn't done before in any deep way, it was a trajectory of, you know, birth, flourishing, and dissolution. I mean, that seemed to be like a life cycle for these things, and it was, in a sense, an elegiac, a sad story, perhaps. And I actually used the word failure, because there was a lot of reflection which said we were defeated. And certainly, by the way, that was my experience as a young, you know, I had an extremely intense experience at the height of the counterculture in London. I was born in Ireland and sent away to one of these carceral schools I was telling you about at the age of 6 for a regime of cold baths, buggery and the lash, to be trained into the running the English Empire for them. And as a very, very young medical student, I went to an extraordinary event in London at the Rand House, where I went to listen to Allen Ginsberg, and several people came from California. Emmett Grogan, who had been among the diggers in Haight-Ashbury. It was an extremely intense experience for me, and I've never forgotten. I use the word failure to describe this trajectory, and somebody in the group sitting over there said, "Hang on, stop right there. You guys come up from Berkeley, you know, you academics, you pointy heads, and you tell us we're a failure, you know, talk about failure. That's crap. I wouldn't have given up a day of my life on a commune. Right? 10 years we had. that's, you know, it's insulting. Apologize. So I was just thinking about that. But before I could answer, over here, Redwing, for that was her name, said, not to me, but to Luna. Said, Luna, I've known you most of our lives. We were in the beloved community together on the Table Mountain Commune. How dare you deny that it was a failure? I know what your dreams were. Of course it was a failure. You're shitting on your own dreams. How dare you? So we knew we had a project. No, I mean by the unmasked of history. You know, was it a failure? Was it a success? I actually don't think these are very interesting questions, ultimately. Whether to adjudicate whether Table Mountain Commune was a success or a failure. I mean, certainly there was a dissolution, there was sadness. To see two sisters turn out in with such different life trajectories. You know, one who's still on the land, whose family had been able to buy it, architect built house, kids at Princeton, and her beloved sister who's has breast cancer on a midnight shift doing a midwife living in a small room in Fort Bragg. At the time, you know, all those resources outside capital, that was suppressed. It was a different world, right? Since the restoration of the right, since Reagan and the rest of it. Yeah, so we could say it's a story of failure, but actually one of the things that's clear about this is that there are lessons here, particularly about commoning, about a rejection of the reign of the commodity. And as I say, our masters have no plan B. We're facing very likely the end of coastal civilization. I work in an earth sciences building, and the climate scientists are much more pessimistic than they are in public. Very likely we're facing the inundation of most of the great cities of the planet, which are, you know, on the coasts. That, okay, it's a disastrous thing, but, you know, it's time to get down to business on this. And I'm not sure that seizing the reins of the state is going to do it, the old Marxist dream. I'm sort of on the side of Bakunin and Kropotkin on this. I think it's going to have to be something neither private nor public, as it were, but common. Public, as I said, public parks is not really the opposite of private in the way that I think we need. We're going to have to go common, because commons have an outside. It's a world of ampleness, but one in which we take care of each other and draw on the resources of the world in a way that is not, I don't want to say sustainable, because I think, and this is where Chuck Marx, of course, was quite right, that in a way the earth is our metabolism. We are the animal that produces itself through the destruction and production of our livelihood together. So perhaps we'll take a break now and we can have a conversation after that.